I mean, mental health is health. There, nothing happens in mental health apart from some physical manifestation, and nothing happens physically without some emotional component. And so to pretend that it's not happening does nothing but hurt injured workers, and it costs employers and carriers money.
Welcome to It's Settled, the Ametros podcast. Each episode, we're going to dig into the humanity in workers' compensation and insurance claims, exploring the stories of injured people and those who support them, as well as the good work professionals are doing in the industry. And now, I invite you to join me, Sean Dean, General Counsel at Ametros and the host of It's Settled. Now, it's settled. Let's get on to the episode.
We have Dr. Les Curte here with us today, and May, as many of you may know, is Mental Health Month, and Dr. Les is very busy on the speaking circuit right now, I can tell. I had the great pleasure of hearing Dr. Les give a very moving and insightful fantastic talk at Comp Laude for the People's Choice portion. And I was, like many others, was in tears. It was just incredible. And we're not going to be going into that stuff today, but I guess I'm giving listeners the background. It was the impetus behind me wanting to contact Dr. Les and get him on the podcast. So I couldn't be more grateful and happy for your time. I know you're incredibly busy, but I've looked up to you for years and seen your postings and articles. So I'm really happy to have you here, Dr. Les. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Sean. I appreciate it. And it's good to be here. I appreciate the opportunity.
So for just rolling right into it, for people who don't know you or your background, how did you get into the niche of workers' compensation and the industrial side relative to mental health versus just going solely private practice?
I always laugh when people ask that question, because almost all of us say something about how it happens by accident.
Yep.
Right. So actually, I've been in some form or fashion of mental health treatment for almost 50 years now. About 22 years ago now, I got a job working, reviewing files in disability insurance on the mental health side. My sort of bread and butter in my treatment at that time was really treating people with comorbid physical and psychological distress. And so that's what I ended up doing. I found that I really, really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the people in the industry. At that time, I was really focused in disability insurance. Gradually over time, as I got interested in workplace mental health, which it occurred to me, I'm looking at these files, and so much of this related to the workplace and what was going on with work and, people's motivation to be at work or return to work. Or lack of it, I got really interested. So just gradually, I got more and more involved in the workers' comp side of things. I've been in leadership positions in different companies. I'm an industry consultant, and currently I'm senior VP for behavioral health at Axiom Medical, but also an industry consultant talking to other folks. And I got involved with Comp Laude about 5 years ago. Okay. I think what really intrigues me is just how little we understand in the mental health community of how important it is for people to be at work, or at least to be able to feel like they're living a full and life in which they're contributing. And that's what attracted me, of course, to Comp Laude, because that's their real mission. And I think that just I felt like I had something to offer there. You know, I kind of understood work and I understood behavioral health, and so it was a natural fit.
What's your this is probably a big question, but what's your general philosophy around the treatment, mental health treatment in an industrial injury? And I bring this up because we've had some side conversations offline about sort of the shotgun approach versus the scalpel, and very thoughtful and deliberate delivery of mental health services versus just trying to cover things in such a broad range to where they're so diluted. And also the methodology of the delivery of treatment. You know, we had talked about sometimes people just need to be heard and need a person to hear them versus, you know, structured therapeutic sessions, things like that. So forgive me for the big question, but I'll let you go for it.
That's all right. This is my place of passion at the moment. I think what happens in workers' comp in particular, because there's this question of causation and who's going to pay for it, who's going to own it. You know, we have all of those questions, which are really administrative in nature. Clinically speaking, there's no distinction here. I mean, mental health is health. There, nothing happens in mental health apart from some physical manifestation, and nothing happens physically without some emotional component. And so to pretend that it's not happening does nothing but hurt injured workers, and it costs employers and carriers money. But the thing is that it's not all, as you said, it's not all the same. You know, there's everything from stress.
Yeah.
You know, you've probably heard me say, like, you know, raise your hand if you're not stressed. And of course, nobody raises their hand except people who are willing to lie.
Yeah.
you know, all the way across the spectrum of psychological symptoms, which may or may not respond to treatment. You know, stress doesn't really need treatment. Stress needs resources. It needs an ear. It needs an outlet. Psychological symptoms may or may not respond to treatment, but certainly can use a listening ear and support, which, by the way, claims managers are in the best position, frankly, to provide. And then there are psychiatric conditions, diagnosable conditions, which will respond to treatment and may or may not need specialty treatment. And again, you know, we get into this discussion in comp about, well, but that's not really comps to own. That's not really related to the injury. Well, great, except that if you don't pay attention to it and don't address it, it just drags the claim out and, again, hurts both the worker, the employer, and the carrier. Everybody loses in that circumstance. So that's a big answer to your big question, but
no, and it's really insightful, and some of the best ideas are so plainly obvious. They're just sitting in front of your nose. I mean, we don't think about it. At least I don't, and I need to do a better job. You can't separate an injury, especially one that removes someone from their employment, and a mental health component. I mean, it's there. And I guess it sort of, it draws my mind to the pandemic, where we had this big socially collective experience where we were frightened about getting sick and dying. You know, we were seeing these staggering statistics about people getting sick. And most of us weren't going into an office unless we were a frontline service type worker. It was a very confusing time, at least initially, even around like regulations of, you know, when to mask, when to not, what's going on with a vaccine. And there was the isolation component,
right,
that I think exacerbated, you know, folks' underlying mental health issues or just cause them to present themselves just because of circumstances and situation. But I guess where I'm going with it is, you can't, it should be plain to see, but we miss it. You can't separate a life-changing event like this, or sickness or an illness, from a mental health component. And it's pertinent that we're talking about it right now during May, Mental Health Month.
Absolutely. And it cuts both ways. You know, we know that people who are highly stressed, highly distressed emotionally, are more likely to get injured on the job. I mean, we know that's true. That's not blaming mental health for injuries. That's just acknowledging that that's a fact, that, you know, someone who's has mental distress that is going unnoticed and unattended is more likely to have an accident. So let's pay attention. Yeah. That's on the prevention side. Yeah. And then on the treatment side, again, you know, I don't care who owns it. From a clinical perspective, if we don't pay attention to it, we're going to spend more money and waste more money, and workers are going to stay out of work for longer. I mean, those are all things that we know. They're all just facts.
So on the treatment side, over, you know, the course of your career, how have you seen things change, I guess, one? And two, what are some best practices to implement in the workers' comp setting when someone files a claim and presents with an injury? How do you deploy? Is there a triage process? Is it that it's cookie cutter and everyone sort of gets I see you're shaking your head. I agree with you there. But like, what, talk a little bit about some best practices in mental health in work comp.
I think a good place to start is with the claims person who first talks to that injured worker. You know, how often do we hear from injured workers that that first contact is made all the difference, both for ill or for good, right? The claims experience that works well for injured workers is a claims person who is interested, who's curious, who's supportive, you know, who's willing to kind of hear the story and do what they can to make sure the person is taken care of. That's the most important thing. We got to take care of whatever the needs are in that moment, right? There are specific screening. There are ways of screening for mental distress that we can do up front. But frankly, the first best practice is teach claims people to listen carefully and reflect and make sure that they communicate that they're hearing the injured worker.
I love that. I know you probably have 500 more, but I want to stop just to drive that point home, because I think it oftentimes gets missed. We go, well, I'm not a psychologist. I don't know. It's the point I think that you're making, and forgive me if I'm putting words in your mouth, is that it's through the whole pendency of the claim. It's not just at some point where we go, okay, now we're going to talk about mental health. I mean, it can be claim filing and the first interface the adjuster has with the injured worker.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I think we this is why I talked about that spectrum, because we mistake mental health with conditions that require treatment. But that's not the important part. The important part is we're relating to another person, and our mental health is part of that. So, you know, that claims contact throughout the claim, you know, how many stories have we heard where that's both gone wrong and gone really, really right? You know, and so the trick is, frankly, first place to start is help it go right more often and more consistently. And that you can do by training claims people. And it isn't training claims people to be mental health professionals. Honestly, at that stage of things, my professional brethren may not like what I'm about to say, but the truth is, mental health professionals are not the best people at that point. The best people at that point are empathetic listeners who understand the system and can reassure the person that they're talking to and provide important information. That's claims people.
I love that. I think
that made you think of another question. I could tell
it did. It for sure did. Yeah. It got me thinking to prevention for some reason. And, mm-hmm. And I hope none of the listeners or you, Dr. Les, think that I'm being cynical. I'm not, I'm just trying to call it how I see it, but there's this phrase that employers use a lot about self-care. Mm-hmm. And there are things that get implemented, such as, you know, there's a wellness room where there might be a Zen sand rock garden. And maybe there's some, I don't know, there's like a nice picture in the corner of, it's usually a nature scene. And maybe there's, you know, some sort of $20 gadget that you can buy on Amazon that's like, it's like a waterfall or I don't know, something like that. Right. And it's right. A quiet room. And it's like, that's the solution to mental health. Or maybe it's one time a year they'll do a yoga class. I think that employers' hearts are in the right place when they do things like that. I think people are trying to go, gosh, well, you know what we can do? What can we do? We want to acknowledge it. But to me, it seems like it's, and I think there's a ton of root causes of why that happens, but I think the efficacy of those efforts are just for naught.
I agree with you for what it's worth. Maybe not for naught. Those self-care tools are useful, right? They're useful for managing stress. They're useful for learning how to cope with situations that are difficult. But when we don't understand the workforce as a whole and the workplace as a whole, only targeting those individual interventions misses the point. I promise not to do a commercial for Axiom, but you know, one of the reasons that I went there was that I had an opportunity to help build a solution that started with triage and using nurse case managers to understand who needs support, who needs resources, and who needs treatment, and then getting them to the right place, right? So we built all of that into it, but part of what makes it difficult for employers is that it has to start with two things. One is that it has to start with, you have to understand what's going on in your workforce. What are the particular stressors in the workplace? What are the challenges that employees have? And it's, by the way, it's going to be different by generations. You know, we saw in the pandemic that the youngest part of the workforce is most likely to talk about mental health, complain about mental health, complain about stress, but they are also the least likely to seek traditional psychological care. Huh. Older workers are much more likely to, you know, suck it up, quote unquote, but also if they really are in trouble, will seek first they'll go to their primary care doc, and if it's recommended, they'll go to traditional care. So you have to understand your workforce. That involves some work on the part of the employer.
Well, gosh, that got me thinking. If a frontline adjuster who's interfacing with a claimant is really the first stop on the, you know, the path to ensuring that mental health is addressed, and that adjuster has 300 pending files and they're stressed.
Yep.
How on earth are they able to dig deep and find their empathy and compassion and set the tone? So, I mean, that's huge. Oh,
well, you know, but it's, it,
but if there's a sign that says live, laugh, love, or breathe, then It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly. That's going to make it all better. That is a huge problem. The thing is that if you really boil it down, I have this same conversation, by the way, with physicians who complain about they've only got 6 minutes on average with a patient. You know, how can I afford the time to listen to them? To which my answer is twofold. One is, how can you afford not to listen to them? Because eventually it's going to take up more of your time and effort.
Yeah.
You know, what's the, and secondly, it actually, the way that you phrase things is the thing that matters. It doesn't take a long time for you to feel like I've heard what you said. All it takes is a quick reflection that acknowledges, here's what you said. You know, let's explore that a little bit more.
Not to make you do a solo role play, but like, give the listeners an example in a claims context of how that would manifest itself.
Well, so imagine that you just called me and you just told me that you got hurt. You know, it's like, and I'm listening for your tone of voice. You sound pretty matter of fact. I'm just making this up.
Yeah.
You sound pretty matter of fact. So the first thing I'm going to say is, so I hear that you've been injured. Tell me about what happened. All right. Let people talk. If in the course of that, I hear that you're really angry because, you know, your coworker left a bucket in the way and you tripped over it. Again, I'm making it up,
yeah.
You know, all I have to do is acknowledge that, you know. So, you know, so part of this right now is that you're really angry with your coworker for leaving the bucket there and probably also a little embarrassed because you tripped over it. Right? It's all it takes. And now all of a sudden, I've heard what the person is saying. I've acknowledged their emotion. I've let them express it. What happens instead if I ignore it? And I say, well, what was in the bucket? How heavy was the bucket? You know, I just focus on the injury.
Right.
Those two things take exactly the same amount of time.
Yeah.
Right. For me,
one's adversarial, the other
isn't.
Is
correct.
Yeah.
Right. That's the thing. It takes the same amount of time. But I'm going to back up a step and say something on a bigger scale again that gets to the same point that if, you know, what's the most common outcome of a workplace injury? The correct answer, which takes claims people in particular and physicians even more particularly a long time to get to, is people get better and go back to work.
Yep.
Right? That's the most common response. Well, why don't we know that? Why do we get cynical? Because it's the 15 or so percent that don't work out that way that drive us crazy.
Yeah.
Part of that 15% are people who are catastrophically injured, who are going to take a long time, and they need a lot of intervention. The rest of that 15% are people who are angry with their employer, they're angry with their coworkers, they felt like they had a poor work environment, and they feel like they're not being heard by their adjuster, and they are going to make the adjuster's life miserable. It's going to take longer if you don't pay attention to that, then if you actually acknowledge it and just work with that person.
And you know, to that point, it's not fair if we're looking at sort of the 80-20 rule. And I've talked to claims executives who say we need to stop. And I've been guilty of this. And when claims folks get in a room, we almost romanticize the difficult cases and they're outliers. And it's not fair to the vast majority of injured workers who present claims that this will never happen to. They'll get better and they'll go back to work. But we tend to fit them into that difficult case paradigm and they don't deserve it. That's
right.
A huge
right. And what triggered that was you're talking about, you know, here's an adjuster who has 300 claims in their caseload. Well, of course, the ones that are going to stand out are the ones that are the most difficult and take the most time. And exactly as you said, you know, you punish the 280 people by ignoring them or by getting jaded, and you focus on those people. It's a natural thing. I'm not blaming the adjusters mm-hmm. for this. I mean, this is partly the system and how we've developed it. Something that's really kind of gotten worse over the years, I think, is that we've tended to turn claims management into a transaction. And we keep pretending that we can train these people as if they are customer service reps and who are doing a certain number of transactions in a certain amount of average time. And we think that that's going to work. And the problem is that it's a fundamentally people-oriented business. You know, how do you help a claims person do that? Well, first of all, you set up systems that help them do it. But also, frankly, it's a lot more rewarding.
Yeah.
You know, it's much more fun to interact with a person than it is to, like, you know, look at a computer screen and make sure you've got all the you've got all the check boxes.
Go from step 234 to step 235. Yeah.
Right. You know, it's just, you know, that's, I'm actually involved in a webinar later today that that's about that. Like, how do we help people kind of get attracted to this industry? And part of it is emphasizing and giving people the tools to relate to other people. I mean, what's more interesting than that?
What was the inflection point? I mean, you've been in this business a while. It used to be you'd go to a conference and it would be like, if you looked at a session, you'd be like, oh, cost mitigation strategies, you know, very legal focused, technical focused. And then all of a sudden, I don't know when it was, I want to say maybe 8 years ago, I'm just shooting from the hip, you started seeing like people oriented, I forget whatever buzzword you want to pick, and I think it's great that it's shifted. But what were some of the factors that caused us to look at comp differently and apply these more empathetic models, human focused models, mental health focused stuff?
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I would agree with you that I think there are actually two waves. So the first wave, I agree, was about 8 years ago. And all of a sudden, you know, I felt like, oh my gosh, people are finally listening. You know, like there are people on the other end of this.
Yeah.
I mean, frankly, what I think was driving it was that costs continued to skyrocket. And we realized that the system wasn't working the way that it was working. And this applies, by the way, in both disability and workers' compensation. You know, so occupational injury or non-occ, both. The same thing was happening, that we finally kind of got to this place where, all right, this isn't working. What's the missing piece? And the missing piece was staring us right in the face. It's that we're not relating to people. We're not paying attention to folks. But unfortunately, that first wave, I think, lasted about 2 to 3 years. And I think what happened at first in response to that notion was that we saw a whole cottage industry built up around providing mental health support to workers' compensation. And we were shooting from the hip. We didn't understand work. We didn't understand the workplace. We were providing blanket treatment to everybody, and it didn't produce the outcomes. And so the industry lost interest.
Interesting.
Right. And so it kind of faded away if you think back to the conferences.
Yeah.
And then the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
And in the pandemic, we began to talk about mental health. And this is got to be a particular interest of mine, because I kept seeing these numbers that were like astronomical, like we've doubled a number of mental health conditions. It's like, is that really true? Well, what happened was that people were finally talking about it and people were reporting more stress. Well, okay, of course we were. We had to change the way that we worked, or in my case, nothing really changed about my work. I work from home. But I was working from home, so nothing changed for me, while all around me, it felt like the world was on fire. So we were all stressed. COVID didn't create a wave of mental health conditions. What it did was it shone a light on a problem that had been growing for a long time. So we started to talk about it again. And now I'm seeing in conferences, I'm seeing that human focus again. And what I'm hoping for is that this time we address the systemic changes that have to happen in order to support claims people, claimants, you know, employers. Like, I agree with you. Most employers really want to be helpful, but they don't know what to do. And some, to be fair, are balk when it's like, okay, yes, I understand, but I need to know more about your workforce. Like, how are they doing? Have you checked with them? You know, and a lot, what I hear back is, well, we have an EAP for that. Well, great, but that's, you know, 3 to 5 sessions of the same thing for everybody, some of whom will benefit and some of whom actually don't need that. So let's figure out a systemic approach. I'm hoping that's what happens now, because that cottage industry approach actually made things worse, because carriers started to say, well, if I let somebody go to get treatment, then, you know, it's a black hole and they're going to be in treatment forever. Yeah, that could be. But if you design a program that's really focused on helping people get back to function, that doesn't have to happen that way. We can do it better, but that takes some real work. So I'm hoping that's what happened. I think we're in that second wave right now, and we're starting to pay attention. And I hope we do something different with it.
A few things you said got me thinking, and I don't mean to turn this into a plug, but I had the director of Kind Souls Foundation on, and I was so moved by their mission, I decided to be an ambassador. And Kind Souls, it's very simple. They just provide a warm line for an injured individual or their family members to call up and talk. And it's not mental health counseling per se. These aren't, you know, psychologists or psychiatrists on the phone, but they just get to talk and they get referred out to services and they just get heard. And it was just like so simple, and it was a missing component that,
it's brilliant.
That's brilliant. And I guess to your point, there's a whole spectrum of services that are very nuanced that could be deployed. It doesn't have to be on one end. It's psychotropic medication with a weekly counseling. Now that may be very applicable to certain people, and it's a must have versus nothing. And it's either or. And I think a lot of people think binary in terms of mental health.
Yes.
In general, and especially in the workers' compensation realm.
Right. And I think part of the problem, of course, is that, you know, workers' compensation is highly regulated. It's controlled by rules and regulations and law that determine a lot of that. And so, unfortunately, that's a very uncomfortable fit for actual human interaction and the way that it works. Yeah. Right. That example is like perfect to me. What you just said, what a great idea. And imagine if you had claims people who were trained to do a little bit of that listening up front, provide some support, and then gave them that phone number. And said, listen, I'm going to help you with the claims part of this and negotiating all of that, making sure you get taken care of. Here's a place you can call if you just need some support.
Yeah.
You know, imagine that scenario. So claims people get to do what claims people do. You're not involved in all of that. And now you've got this other resource. And that resource can then refer into other services if they're needed. You know, again, if somebody has a major depressive disorder, they're very seriously depressed. It probably wasn't caused by the injury. It almost certainly wasn't caused by the injury. At worst, it was exacerbated by the injury. Nevertheless, it will delay recovery and in most cases will virtually double it. Now, you tell me, what's more cost efficient, right? Pay attention or pretend that it didn't happen. And again, maybe the employer's not on the hook for that care, but maybe the employer's insurer is on the hook for providing that care as part and the referrals part of the work comp claim. There are many different, you almost can't have a single solution. The single solution is to acknowledge mental health is health. Yeah. It's all one package. You know, you don't come without your emotions and your manner of thinking, and neither do I. None of us do. So that's become my mission, is really to focus on how do we take that idea and make it practical.
Mental health is health. With that, I think that's the perfect note to leave it on. Dr. Les Curte, I really appreciate you being here. This was such a wonderful conversation, and I'd love to have you back on the podcast in the future.
Anytime. I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks.
All right, Mel.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of It's Settled, the Ametros podcast. For more information and episodes, you can visit us at our website at ametros.com. That's ametros.com. Or head over to iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. We hope you enjoyed this episode and look forward to sharing more stories of people overcoming their workplace accidents and bodily injury claims and those who are working hard to make a difference for them. So it's settled. We'll see you next time.